Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Hello there. You are very welcome along to Golf Weekly. We are doing this during interesting times. We are all in our houses. There is me in my house. There is Fionn Davenport, as usual, in his house. Hello, Fionn.
Hi, lads.
And joining us, a face and a voice from the distant past, Golf Weekly friends, Dave McIntyre. What are you doing here? You must be bored.
You have no idea, Joe. I've been begging you for about a week to put me back on the pod just so I can resurrect some past glories. But yeah, to say I'm bored, well, bored is probably the wrong term. I have plenty to do, but this is the first remotely work-related thing that I've engaged in 2 weeks.
Since the day
that Scotland beat France in the Six Nations, I have not done anything remotely work-orientated. So I've been craving something like this.
Mm. How surreal is all this, Fionn Davenport?
I mean, I'm older than both of you, so never in my lifetime have we had anything even approaching this. Like, this isn't even in the same neighborhood as any crisis that I can remember. Like, it's so unprecedented. And strangely, you think that we're also ill-equipped for it. I mean, and in many ways, we clearly are. Like, you know, like trying to figure out, like, how to self-isolate and how to adjust our lives accordingly. But it's not to strike too Pollyanna-ish a note, but it's amazing how you find inner resources that you really didn't think you had in order to kind of deal with just like small but crucial daily things that come up that we've never had to confront before. Now I'm in an optimistic phase, so it's like a wave for me, the whole thing. So like we're recording when I'm having a good couple of days, because for the first 4 days or so, and also it's worth pointing out that I'm in the UK, which is at least a solid week behind Ireland in terms of attitudes, shutdowns, so on and so forth. So for the first 4 days, I'm meant to be writing, and I couldn't write a lick, not a word, because just full of anxiety and just overwhelmed by a sense of like, oh, what are we going to do? How am I going to get through the next few months? How am I? And luckily enough, 4 days into it, I feel more secure. I feel calmer. And I'm trying to find the positives, which involves looking at a lot of old golf stuff on the Golf Channel and watching a lot of box sets.
Mm. And are your fears primarily health, or is it economics,
financial,
or is it just financial?
Financial.
Yeah, a lot of
as
people in that boat.
Person, yeah, as a self-employed person, I have, you know, obviously, and also as a travel writer, you know, my industry has just disappeared. And as much as I know that when this is all over, we are going to go through we're back and we're open for business explosion. And so my services will be once again very much in demand. So there is always that light at the end of the tunnel. You know, I have absolutely no problem saying is that like my meager resources will keep me going until maybe the end of June. You know, if I don't earn a penny between now and the end of this crisis, I can survive paying my mortgage, my bills, etc., more or less until the end of June. And then beyond that, I don't know.
Well, thankfully, I mean, I saw during the week there were a raft of economic measures announced over there in terms of people out of work and mortgage holidays and all of that stuff. So hopefully that kicks in, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Dave McIntyre, yeah. I should tell the listeners who can't see us, you're broadcasting from the children's playroom.
I am, yeah. I've commandeered it for the hour or so. It's been, last week has just been incredibly surreal. Obviously, since last Friday, the kids have been out of school and all of the childcare has been withdrawn overnight. And suddenly, I've gone from a semi-full-time dad to a full-time dad. My wife is still working 4 days a week. And you're up at 7:30 in the morning and the kids are going to bed about 8 in the evening. And that is 12 and a half hours that have to be filled. And a lot of it is done within the four walls of the house. Obviously can't take them to see their grandparents, which is really hard on the grandparents in particular, but the kids are wondering why they're not visiting Nana and Grandad and Granny and Grandad, and they wonder why they can't go and play with their friends, and they're shouting over the neighbor's fence asking why they can't come into their house. And obviously there's the usual skirmishes and quarrels that any two siblings will have, but they tend to be overemphasized then when you're kind of in, not quite lockdown, but a little bit of isolation. So it's been a weird week. The thoughts of it going on for another 4 months or so, if that potentially could be the case, is a very hard thing to stomach. But look, there's far people in far worse positions than we are, which is what we keep have to tell ourselves. We'll just plow on. Just, it is literally day by day for us, because you just have to think hard on how to try and fill the day. I've just come from a 3-hour stint in the park where every minute counts. Every minute gets closer to 7 o'clock.
And one last area of all this, and Fionn, I know you are a news junkie. I mean, you follow news at the most boring of times. And even just the other day, I found myself reading the Imperial College of London COVID-19 response team's paper. I mean, because what else would you be doing? And, our brains are all programmed to go towards any sign of danger. You know, we just have that bias. If there's the potential for danger, our brain wants to know about it. And I was saying to Keith Wood on Wednesday Night Rugby during the week, in World War One, they probably had papers the odd day. World War Two over in the UK, maybe the odd address from the King or Winston Churchill and the news on the radio. And we have, by human standards, infinite information here. Yeah. I mean, you can, from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to bed, if you can sleep at all, you can read about this, engage with this, and think about this, and you'll have plenty to keep you going. So where are you in that specter of keeping informed and also trying to keep your sanity?
I think indulging in that kind of overload of news, which there is, and it's all one topic, is the worst thing I can do. So what I've done is like you, I have tried my level best to stick to news headlines in the morning. I listen to Radio 4 here, so, you know, I trust that the Today program is not going to steer me wrong. And then I have attended, and then in fairness now, because of the peculiar circumstances of Britain, I watch Boris's 5 p.m. press conferences, but they leave me just bemused, frustrated, none the wiser. As you say, as a news junkie, I realized that for the sake of my mental health, it is absolutely important that I avoid, like, I'm avoiding Twitter, or certainly I ignore everything that I see on it that doesn't make me laugh. But it feels a bit like a crocodile rolling its prey, you know, like I feel like my brain is being tortured, just consuming. So, but like you, it's like, you know, you read the Imperial College thing because you feel, well, this is a legitimate source, so there's actual solid hard fact. When in truth, and perhaps you guys might think differently, when in truth, the three things that I know that are really, really important are, I keep washing my hands, I keep my hands as clean as possible, I am isolating, I am maintaining a 2-meter distance from everybody I meet other than my own wife. And I am not going anywhere where there are crowds of people or anything like that. I am avoiding those. And so with those three things in mind, I'm trying to just kind of plow on, try and keep my day as normal as possible and not give in to that temptation to, there's a news feed, or I'm going to check. Because ultimately, like, when you actually parse it down, it's like, what new information are you getting? Like, there is. It's the same old shite, you know? Sorry.
Sorry, if I've given the impression I'm not on Twitter and I haven't been overindulging, that is the wrong impression. I have been doing a terrible job of blocking the information.
As I said, I think for my own mental health, I think it's key. And I only speak for myself. As someone who would have consumed news morning, noon and night, I just find that for this is not good for me. And I almost think wistfully about those people in the crisis of the past, whether it's World War One, World War Two, who had, like, you know, a daily newspaper, a news report maybe on the radio, and then that's it, and then gossip down in the corner, and that's it. I was just walking down from like my local village, which is less of a village, in a collection of four houses, and I met two lads, stood at a safe distance, and they filled me with like 17 different conspiracy theories about what is, what isn't. And I'm like walking away going, oh my God, I can't take any of this stuff on.
From a golfing perspective, then, obviously, it's in lockdown. So the Masters postponed. That was well over a week ago. The US PGA postponed this week. The Open, as things stand, is maintaining the stance that it could go ahead, although I think it's clear none of this will go ahead. But the RNA said in a statement on Thursday that it's proceeding as planned to host the Open and the Women's Open later this summer, but they're considering contingency options available to us, which, of course, it will probably come to that. The Open scheduled for July 16th at Royal St. George's, the Women's Championship August 20th at Royal Troon. Rory McIlroy was talking on American radio, Sirius XM, about the Masters maybe in October. They close Augusta traditionally during the summer months, actually. So, I mean, it's closed anyway over the summer, but he was saying October could be quite cool, could be very different. Excuse me, that's my phone situation. I'll knock off those in a second. Masters maybe, I don't know. Padraig Harrington was on Off the Ball during the week. The Ryder Cup is September 25th. I mean, September. God, I hope we're back towards some kind of normality. Yeah. September. It was interesting. So, look, he denied, James Corrigan in The Telegraph had the story that effectively they're getting ready to cancel the Ryder Cup. Obviously, you know, it just can't go ahead and they've already accepted that. Harrington said, look, I've been in the meetings. That conversation has not happened. Certainly not to that extent. The interesting one I asked him, Dave, I said, say we get to a point in September where things are, you know, the world is starting to turn a little bit again and public health officials go to, say, to the European Tour and the PGA Tour or whoever runs the Ryder Cup. I think it's the USGA when it comes to America. But regardless, public health officials say to everybody, look, we can go ahead on September 25th behind closed doors with just the players. Yeah, social distancing is very possible in golf and we have the infrastructure very tight and we can do this across TV. Or if you wait what we estimate to be another X number of months, sometime in 2021, you can do the full shebang with the crowds, the Ryder Cup as we know it. Harrington was of the opinion that actually, wouldn't it be great for everyone to have the Ryder Cup to watch on TV around the world, even if it was behind closed doors? And let's do that. That would be his feeling. Yes, it'd be a loss, but let's put this thing on behind closed doors. Where are you? What would you like?
Our younger listeners are probably too young to understand that the Ryder Cup used to be played in odd-numbered years. And the Ryder Cup at Brookline in 99 was the last time that was the case. September 11th intervened, and the meeting at the Belfry was then played in 2002 with the same teams that had qualified the previous year on the points race. And since then, it's been in even-numbered years. So it's not like this has never happened before. Mm. I can't imagine what to me is the single greatest TV spectacle in any sport every 2 years being played with no crowds. What makes it such amazing viewing at home is the roar from around the golf course, is maybe 25, 50,000 people crowded around one hole. People frantically trying to figure out what's going on in other singles matches or foursomes or formals. And to me, the prospect of sitting out to watch the Ryder Cup with no crowds, I would rather wait another year so that we can guarantee, and hopefully the world will have moved on significantly by the autumn of 2021. The other major reason for me wanting it, if necessary, to be postponed for a year, is if you look at the points list at the moment and the current standings, a lot of guys who obviously have yet to get their seasons really into full gear because they know they will be good enough and will play enough good golf between now and September to qualify for the team automatically, they're nowhere near doing so. And there is not a very glamorous list of players who've, if the team was to be picked on a current situation where there are no more turners to be played, it's not as appetizing in the Ryder Cup as it would be. And there is a list too long of those who you feel should be there that wouldn't be there. When I put those two reasons together, I don't think it should go ahead unless A, there's a lot of golf play between now and the qualifying schedule closes down, and if there are crowds there or not. Mm.
Fionn?
I agree. I'm not as big or as enamored of the Ryder Cup as Dave famously is, who ranks it as the best golf tournament of them all. But I couldn't agree with him more. I think without crowds, then it's just another episode of Shell's Wonderful World of Golf. You know, and here from the gorgeous landscape of, and then nothing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think for I absolutely agree. I think everything Dave says makes absolute sense, and putting it off by another year is, I don't think is a terrible issue. For me, obviously of greater concern is the four majors. You know, I think that anything that can be done to try and play, if not all four, two of them before the actual end of this year. I mean, I don't know if that's possible or if that's feasible. But if they were to be able to do that, I would, that would be the thing that I would look to more than, you know, skipping a Ryder Cup for another year. That doesn't, yeah.
Yeah. I would have thought it, when it comes to it, who knows where we're going to be, but when we get to September, October, November, and this thing maybe has been suppressed, or maybe a vaccine has magically been found way ahead of the usual schedule, when we're beginning to move again, I mean, you only need 4 weeks to play the four majors, obviously, or 5-6 weeks to cram them in. So, it's doable in that respect. Behind closed doors, golf, tournament golf could be a very strange thing. I mean, ball landing on green and it's a phenomenal shot and no applause really does feel like a tree falling in the woods with nobody there to hear it.
Well, let's not kid ourselves, though. Is that, we see a lot of that. You could rock up to any European tournament, particularly at times in the early parts of the season or the very beginning of the season. So I'm talking October, November. Could be in South Africa, could be in China or somewhere, and there are absolutely nobody watching it. And that's the case as well for some PGA Tour events. It's not an alien concept.
No, it's not. So let me paint the picture. It's the 16th at Augusta on Sunday. McIlroy is playing with Woods. They're level.
For a major championship,
Tiger Woods has a hole in one at the 16th at Augusta. A hole in one, Tiger Woods, and nobody applauds.
It would be almost unwatchable.
Be very strange. Very strange. Yeah.
Going back to the point, Joe, on the makeup of the two Ryder Cup teams at the moment. Yeah. If we didn't get these majors played, your point is absolutely valid. Look, you only need 4 weeks to play four golf tournaments. If you look at the American team at the moment, it's Koepka, Johnson, Reed, Woodland, Schauffele, Webb Simpson, Justin Thomas, and Tiger Woods. They're the top eight. Right on the bubble is Finau, Kuchar, DeChambeau, and Cantley. Corey Harrington does not want to be going to Whistling Straits with his current team against that team. He wants to have the best position to be a winning Ryder Cup captain. Mm. And that's why I think it's absolutely crucial that if there is no more golf played, this Ryder Cup cannot go ahead.
Or they say to Harrington, these are wartime, you know, this is like a wartime effort. You pick your 12 guys.
Yeah, that changes it entirely.
Yeah. Number one, Shane Lowry. Number two, Graham McDowell. Number three, Padraig Harrington. And Peter Lowry gets the call up. Peter Lowry's back in, 12th man.
And Paul McGinley.
Paul McGinley, obviously. I mean, it goes without saying. By the way, we've had a few people tweet us, lads, and just ask about golf at our level. At the level of hackery. So there was a statement from the Golf Union of Ireland, a joint statement, and the ILGU as well on Thursday. Now, please, if you're listening to this on Sundays Off the Ball, just double check in case anything has changed. We are recording this on Thursday, and obviously due caution and diligence to be exercised at all times. But the current state of play as of the 19th of March is that, and this is according to the GUI, while areas within golf clubhouses may not be available due to the need for social distancing, the sport remains open and accessible. Golf members can still play and enjoy their golf while acting within the guidelines issued by the HSE. And, you know, so social distancing is paramount. Obviously, you have to look at your golf ball as a potential vector. There's no need to touch the pins at any stage. And then there's a raft of advice for golf clubs on the GUI statement as well. They say things like, you know, all bunker rakes may be removed where players play the ball as it lies if possible. Clubs can instruct players to leave the flag in the hole unattended at all times. One person permitted per buggy in line with social distancing and so on. They want all ball washers taken off the course. So, you know, your responsibility to wash bring some ante back. But, you know, if all of those points are observed, then you know you can see how golf in very small groups, and obviously all competitions, inter-club competitions are gone, all that kind of stuff is gone, but you can see how golf, certainly alone, which we might come to, or in twos or maybe even in threes, it is very possible to at all times stay 2 meters plus away from each other. It's very possible not to have to come into contact. You're in the outdoors. It potentially can be done sensibly. Now, clubhouses may become no-go areas, which is a reality we can all accept and live with. But as things stand, golf falls into the bracket of one of those few things that you can do in a pretty similar way to the way you used to do things, which is only about 7 days ago, but it feels like a lifetime ago, Fionn.
Yeah.
So yeah, I get out and golf a little bit, it seems.
I think that's really, really good. I mean, just the other day, I think when I was in the shock of all of this, I said, right, I'm going out, I'm going to play some golf on my own. And now again, I hasten to add, it's almost as though, even though we are right next to each other, we're like in different worlds here in the UK versus Ireland, like in terms of just the accepted level of information versus what's happening here. There is like a disconnect that I struggle to come to terms with, obviously, because I'm so closely following what's happening in Ireland. But that aside, so I went out and I was going to play on my own, and elderly gentleman came over to me and said, oh, you're going out on your own? I said, yeah. And he goes, do you mind if I join you? And I was like, no, absolutely not. And I just automatically, I said, look, but we'll just maintain social distancing. I'm not going to touch anything. And he went, oh, yes. And he was almost like taken aback. And he was like, yes, of course. And of course, over the course of the first couple of holes, he admitted to me that he thought it was all a bit over-exaggerated. And I said, well, I wish I thought were right, I said to him. But what emerged from it was interesting was that he told me, because I'm 72, and the only thing he could respond to was Matt Hancock, the government minister, who said the other day, oh, there is the possibility that we may ask all over 70s to self-isolate for a period of 3 months. So the only government fed bit of information that he had was this. That was it. And even though he admitted that he understood that, you know, this was all for the greater good, is that he was really balking at the idea of, I don't want to be, you know, why me? You know, I'm healthy. And he kept telling me, I'm healthy. I have no underlying conditions. I play golf all the time. It was a very instructive example to come back to the point that you were making, was that at the end of the golf, and we ended up meeting another member who was 84, but because I don't mean this in a show-offy way, but you know, I was a little further than they were on their drives, and we were playing the ball from different positions. It was like I was playing the game on my own. We were all never mind 2 meters. We were, even on the tee boxes, that we would stay well away from the tee box. And then it was, when is our turn? One would walk off and the other one would walk on. So there was like a good 10, 15 yards of separation. And that's as close as we got. And then again on the green, each of us would take turns. We would stand on the edge of a green. And then when it was our turn to putt, each of us walked onto the green, putted, did what we had to do, and walked off, and surrendered the stage, as it were, to the next fellow. And it struck me, now again, I'm not a virologist, I'm not a HSE expert, but given all the advice that we've been told, it seemed to me this was eminently sensible, and in no way did it distract or detract from the enjoyment of the game. And so for that sense, I mean, short of being told otherwise, I think the idea of playing golf, whether on my own, well, primarily on my own, to be honest, is one of the genuine pleasures that I can look forward to over the course of the next however months.
Yeah. Dave, Shane Ryan on Golf Digest wrote a lovely piece about the experience of playing golf on his own. And listeners to this podcast, Golf Weekly, who in the main play golf as well, have all played golf on their own. We have all done it on a summer evening when we couldn't get anyone else to play with on a summer evening. We've gone out there and played like 15 balls per hole, and you know, you're walking left and right to get it, or maybe you're just playing one ball. We've even done it in terrible weather, I suspect, as well. Yeah, Shane Ryan, you know, painted this picture of the experience, and he made a point. He said there's an obsession with trying to define every person in the world as either an introvert or an extrovert. and he described himself as a talkative introvert. He said, I don't shy away from social obligations, but I also enjoy being alone, which might mean I'm more suited to solo golf than your average extrovert. And then he talked about the art of it. He talked about total absorption and concentration, which is not possible with partners. So he said, played that way, solo golf is less a sport and more like meditation. It's an athletic meditation unlike anything you can find in sports. And the lack of other people gives you a chance to look inward and compete on a mental landscape. And now that's quite a deep way of looking at it. But I know you played on your own just this week, wasn't it?
No, I didn't play on my own, no.
Oh.
No, I played, three of us played yesterday. But there was a time when I played a lot of golf on my own. Back in my early broadcasting days, I was living down in Waterford and I would have played on my own twice a week. And I loved it at the time, but that was 10, 15 years ago and I'm in a very different headspace now. I love the company on a golf course. I will walk off the 18th green nowadays, and even if I've played golf like I've been handed a golf club for the first time and the golfing gods have torn me asunder for 18 holes, I still always feel walking off the 18th like I've enjoyed myself. Mm. And it's because of the company that I've been keeping in the previous 4 hours. And to be honest, yesterday's round of golf was therapeutic for me. Myself and a couple of pals went out. We didn't quite keep the distancing to the extent that Phil's talking about, where you know, you left the green free until someone had holed out and then you went on. But it was always 4 or 5 meters between us. We did have one incident where I actually blew my nose into a tissue. Although I'm not under the weather, it's a long story, but the wind picked up a bit of the tissue and blew it towards one of the other lads. And there was hell to pay for a moment. And you can understand why they were so horrified. But yeah. It's very noticeable how quickly the new becomes the norm. Mm. Any putts from inside 3 feet were automatically gimmies. Nobody touched the flagstick. Mm. There are no bunkers in. There's no rakes in the bunkers. I wore 2 gloves for much of the round. Yes, the ball is really the only vector. So I was always conscious throughout of never touching my face until I got back into my car and used some hand sanitizer. But once you get a few holes into it, everything just seemed to be normal. And the conversation wasn't weakened in any way, diluted in any way. The crack was still there. And like Fionn, although I probably won't get to play as often as he does because the other 6 days
your
a
children.
Week, I pretty much have to be here full time. But that one round of golf a week that I pray I'm still able to play over the next however long this crisis takes to subside, is they'll be the best 4 hours of my week outside of the wonderful hours I get to spend with my wife and children, obviously.
Mm. Well, indeed.
That goes without saying.
It does. And I mean, we heard your lovely children in the background there and they sound like they're having a fine time.
I believe that is 3 rooms away. Whatever you heard going on there is 3 rooms away, which gives you an insight as to that all hell must be breaking loose over in the east wing of the house. Do you want to come in? Here's one of them.
Oh, dear. There we go.
Aww. He's yet to have a golf club in his hand. Are you going to play golf someday?
Oh my God, they're all there now.
The invasion has happened, Dave. There's no way of extricating yourself from this situation.
No, they're all in. But no, it's I've been like Sean. Golf is going to become very important, I think, to a lot of people. And I think golf clubs as well, the retention of their membership is absolutely crucial over the next few months.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of gyms, for example, which are closing, they've been inundated with requirements for a freeze on membership and membership to be ceased entirely. As long as golf clubs remain open, that won't be the case. But I'm sure some golf clubs are getting queries as to players and members who may be uncomfortable with playing and would rather have a freeze on their membership. And golf clubs are struggling with membership as it is. I think if you can retain your membership, it's absolutely crucial that you do that.
Yeah. Do you know what's amazing? You're talking there about the new normal. I mean, you've just had 2 kids running around you there for the last 2 minutes. And like the world went viral when this happened on BBC World Service, you know, 18 months ago or 2 years ago. Like, it was the most amazing thing that ever happened. And now it doesn't even pass much comment. You just kept talking, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
It is
normal now.
It really is. So, we'll keep playing as long as it's safe and all the rest of it. And again, due diligence, keep checking all the dispatches from the GUI. They've had regular statements to keep people up to date and check with your golf club as well. A few other quick things to mention. So Rory McIlroy was on Sirius XM on American radio, and the Premier League golf story has been ongoing, as we know, for much of the last 3 or 4 months. And McIlroy, of all people, fielded a call from Brooks Koepka. So he revealed this. McIlroy came out a couple of weeks ago and said this is not for him, and really set a tone and said, you know, he said things like, well, I don't even like where the money is coming from, which was a really strong statement, and it was much celebrated in golf about a fortnight ago. But it seems Brooks Koepka called him. He said, Brooks did call me a couple of weeks ago. He wanted to get my thoughts on it. He wasn't down in Mexico, but he saw what I said down there, and he said, look, Rory, is that what you really feel? And I said, yeah, look, Brooks, it's not something that I want to be part of for a few different reasons. So they had a chat, Fionn, and now Brooks Koepka has come out against it. So, I mean...
Really, and John Rahm.
And John Rahm, yeah,
the
yeah.
The top three players in the world have all come out against it. Now, yeah. So that's interesting. And I suppose it really makes... I was going to say it makes a mockery of, but it really puts into its place the kind of the binary state of things that we often can reduce these stories to. So like Brooks is 100% in favor, Rory is 100% against, oh my God, you know, whereas Brooks made some statements that, oh, I'm going to think about it for a while and see. So we automatically assumed, oh, he's leaving the door open, Rory's shutting the door. And when these are reasonable men who have a vested shared interest, so it's eminently sensible that they would communicate with each other and say, how do you feel? Well, this is how I feel. What I thought was interesting though, and this kind of went unnoticed because of other events, was Phil Mickelson kind of rapping Rory's knuckles. Not so much because he thinks that Rory is wrong for taking the stance that he took, was that he thinks, and I'm paraphrasing, he thinks that Rory is being slightly disingenuous, is that if he'd left or at least made a statement that allowed for the possibility of the door remaining open on the PGL, that he could use it as leverage. And he used the word, you know, Rory could use this as leverage. And more or less he's saying, by saying absolutely no, he's giving up whatever leverage he has, which is, I thought that was kind of curious. And it's, so then what it made me think, and this is an open question to which I have no answer, Mickelson, who has been flirting with the idea quite publicly, playing in Saudi, playing the pro-am in Saudi with two of the guys who are apparently the money behind the PGL. So is Mickelson genuinely interested in this? Or is he, like he accused Rory of, saying, well, you know, if I leave the door open to... Nah, that we can then leverage the PGA to get or to make the changes that most of the top pros would like. I don't know. I mean, what I do know, though, is that sad to say that the likes of Phil Mickelson don't carry a lot of weight anymore. So if Phil Mickelson was to say, oh, I'm all in favor of the PGL, and Brooks, Rory, and John Rahm say, well, I'm not, well, then the PGL isn't going anywhere, you know, because Mickelson doesn't have that kind of muscle anymore, you know.
Yeah.
God almighty, I'm talking about like he's in the mafia or something. Yeah. Your family don't have that kind of muscle no more. But yeah, Mickelson's not the, you know, 10 years ago, sure, not now.
No.
You know? But yeah, so I thought it was interesting. And but having said all of that, I still believe that the PGL story will go away for a while, but it's sure. Not gone.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. What I mean, the Koepka Rahm joining McIlroy intervention was interesting, Dave. But just what was more interesting to me, you know, especially on the back of the Paul Kimmich pieces with Rory, is that despite the quote-unquote rivalry, that Koepka and McIlroy are still on terms where Brooks Koepka will ring Rory and say, hey, what do you think about this? Where are we on this? So their relationship, certainly not frosty, that would suggest. This is not anywhere close to Phil and Tiger. That's what I found kind of interesting as much as anything.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I thought it spoke volumes for the relationship that pair have. And I think it's purely an on-course rivalry. I don't think it extends anywhere beyond the 18th green. Any little snipe that they've had over the last couple of years, like, for example, the one that all of our Golf Weekly listeners will have heard when Koepka questioned whether or not it was even a rivalry at all because McIlroy hadn't won a major since 2014. You could almost see the literal tongue in cheek when these comments are being made. I think they're both from the Nike stable, obviously, when it comes to their apparel and everything that we see them wearing in a golf course. They both seem pretty well-rounded individuals at this stage, both very mature.
Apparel.
Yeah, I wasn't even sure whether that was the first time I've ever vocalized that word out loud. Did I pronounce it correctly?
No.
Apparel.
Apparel.
It would well, I'm going to say it depends on what part of the world you're from. You're Italian. No. You guys probably say it a bit differently.
No. You're thinking of an apparel spritz. That's what you were thinking.
Well, I'm perfectly happy to be corrected on that. And I may not choose to use that word for quite some time. But it doesn't surprise me that someone like Brooks Koepka would talk to the other massive name in the game at the moment just to get a little bit of a steer. And it strikes me as well that it's very mature on Koepka's part as well, because he had no qualms about getting the opinion of somebody that would be construed as a rival. And I'd say he wasn't even veering towards it, but he probably just wanted a little bit of clarification in his own mind. Apart from the relationship that it illustrates between that pair, it also tells me that the PGA Tour is in a very good place as well. I agree with you, Sean, completely, that this PGL situation will only go away temporarily. At some stage over the next 5 to 10 years, it will come back in a lot slightly different guise. Maybe the money might come from somewhere else. Maybe the venues and the relationship with the tour might change slightly. But I don't know how much difference and tweaking to the schedule and the perks and the terms and conditions that players currently enjoy, they actually want. Are there major issues that players have with how the PGA Tour season is set up at the moment? You win a big tournament, you've got a series exemption. Win a major, you've got a 10-year exemption. There are lifetime memberships out there for players who win a sufficient amount of tournaments. There are well over, 60 guys a season that are winning at least $500,000. And the really top guys get paid multi-millions every year. And we haven't even mentioned the FedEx Cup. What leverage do players need at the moment? How much difference would they like to see in their annual schedule? I don't know what they'd want to change at all.
Well, one of the criticisms that was made is that it doesn't really cast the top PGA guys in the best light. But it's true now as it was in the late 60s when Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus were crying against the way, you know, that they weren't getting a bigger share of the pie. And one of them is that, like, given that you can't in the PGA, you're not allowed you can't get a fee for coming on to the event, is that why should a guy who's just come up from, you know, the Nationwide Tour be liable for the exact same pot of money as the number, I'm going to say, a top five player in the world, who has infinitely more talent, who has infinitely bigger draw, who the crowds are coming to see him. They're not coming to see the guy who's ranked 130th in the world. And so there is. And it kind of goes against the ultimately democratic grain of golf that, like, you know, when the event starts, whatever it is, 152 guys, each of them is given a fair chance of winning. And you're all going to win the exact same amount of money. But, like, there's the top guys who go, look, we're doing all the heavy lifting for the tour, so we should be entitled to more. And even though they might invoke, you know, I've never seen an actual individual player stand up and say, this is exactly what I think. When you read the, you know, the good golf journalists who all speak under cover of anonymity, that a lot of them think that, you know. And again, and it's almost as though, to put it into context, I'll repeat again, and I've said it on the pod a few weeks ago, is that in the late 60s, Arnold and Jack led this massive, like, they actually said, we're going to move away from the PGA. We're starting our own organization. And the PGA of America kind of altered the way they did things just to appease them. So, you know, the players, I think this is a major issue in golf, certainly amongst the top guys, you know. That they want a bigger share of the pie.
Yeah, well, it's not going away, I suspect, although in the short term, everything's on hold. Before we go, I mean, one of the more pleasant things to watch if you have your Sky Sports subscription is just golf on some kind of loop if you're just looking for a more pleasant viewing experience. So what have we gone for? Fionn, give us your initial one.
Okay, three things. One, Tee Time Tips, Nick Doherty.
Yeah, big fan.
Best thing. Short of a live golf event that matters, it's amazing. I'm a huge Nick Doherty fan. He's personable, he's funny, he's a brilliant communicator. He also obviously was a very, very good golfer. And so, you know, every aspect of the game, he just has this very personable way of explaining it. Surprisingly, I found myself, not surprisingly that I found myself watching it, but I found myself really enjoying the golf pass that Rory McIlroy has set up. That's presented by Di Doherty, by Nick's wife.
And you just love the Dohertys.
I'm a big Doherty.
I mean, it's your dream dinner. It's your dream double date.
Oh, it is a little bit. Did you see, though, I know, Joe, you've probably seen them all, but I don't know if you've seen them, Dave, but like the stuff that where you have McIlroy with Brandel Chamblee or McIlroy, they have clips of McIlroy giving these teaching seminars or sort of explaining. McIlroy is amazing at explaining what his issues are, what he's trying to do, how his swing works. So he's talking to Chamblee and he's saying, what's your trigger for taking the club away? And he goes, well, it's the back of his left hand that he wants to pull that away, and that at the same time his right elbow gets soft and tucks in under. And I mean, obviously it's not surprising that Rory understands his own swing, but his ability to explain the mechanisms of his own swing is so interesting and educational.
I haven't seen...
And then the third thing...
I'll let you... I know your third thing is in one second. I did see one of them, and there was this amazing moment where Rory is with Michael Bannon on tips, and they're explaining a certain, you know, a takeaway. And, you know, Rory was saying how he was told personally by Jack Nicklaus to imagine blades right in front of him and to not let his hands go near the blades. And the amazing thing is the circle was drawn. The presenter made the point that Michael Bannon grew up idolizing Jack Nicklaus, studied the Nicklaus swing. It informed much of his teaching. He teaches Rory McIlroy from the age of, what, 4, 5, or 6. And then McIlroy gets the tip personally from Jack Nicklaus. It's kind of an amazing, very golf thing, actually.
But for also for golf nerds like us, it's interesting to hear Rory say when asked, so what's your fault? Like, what's the thing that kind of, and he goes, he can take his hands away from his body, you know? Like we just assume that one of the most beautiful swings in the last 50 years of golf that doesn't have any of the same problems that an amateur has. But lo and behold, Rory says he has got this bad habit that he has a tendency to pull his hands away from his body. And I thought that was so interesting. The last thing, though, now obviously it's all the open films, you know, so you can watch them all in loop. But this morning, lads, I watched in absolute fascination. It's only 13 years ago, the 2007 Open from Carnoustie, Porrick's first one. And it's amazing how you forget certain things. Like you forget that Sergio had a 4-shot lead. Like it was his. Like he led from Thursday right until like the end of the front nine on Sunday. It was his to give away. And that 2 bad bogeys, and he still had that the broom handle putter tucked into his belly, that he just snatched 2 terrible putts, 2 bogeys. Harrington was coming up the inside, playing beautiful golf, made a beautiful eagle. But the one I forgot was Andrés Romero. Andrés Romero, who was playing the golf of the gods, had a 2-shot lead on is it the 17th, and goes OB. And that was it. And poof go his chances. And then like, look, as much as, and I know we were all, the idea of a first Irish winner of a major since Fred Daly in 1947 is the most amazing moment, certainly of the last 20 years for me. But that Harrington, like how he went into the Barry Byrne twice on the 18th is the worst kind of course management / the sign of nerves. Just the idea that, like, I'm on the cusp of it. I'm here. All I need to do is make par and I've won.
Yeah.
But it was so exciting. Also, Sergio, how unlucky Sergio was to lip out. Super stuff. Super.
Dave McIntyre, final thoughts on 07?
It's weird, but all the golf shots that were hit, the defining visual in my mind of 07's Open is the ball bobbling along the bridge over the Barry Byrne
Oh, my God.
Thinking just for half a second, Jesus, it might actually make it. It might actually go over the bridge and he'll have saved himself.
But you can hear someone go, stay up, stay up.
Yeah. If there's a round of golf I'd love to watch back, I haven't even checked to see if it's on YouTube. To be honest, I just don't have the time to find 3 or 4 hours to watch a round of golf again, but I want to watch the last round at Augusta in 96. And I'd probably be watching it from behind the couch again, like I was back in 1996. That's something I definitely need to rewatch. On the hands and the blades analogy, it's a brilliant one because, Joe, that's the one major issue I've had on my swing over the last month is my hands moving away from my body. So next time I am swinging, I'm going to imagine there's some kind of a threshing device 2 feet from where my hands are positioned before I take the club back and see if that improves whether I get the thing right or not.
It's a very violent tip, isn't it? I mean, it's very graphic. Yeah. Is there no other way we can do this? But anyway.
Speaking of old Jack tips, is because the other day I watched the 1970 Open Championship from St. Andrews, the famous or the infamous Doug Saunders miss. Mm. And like, you know what's amazing is I was talking to a friend of mine about it and I was like, so you look at, given the swings of the modern age, these beautiful fluid swings, your Adam Scotts, your Rory McIlroys, your Tiger Woodses, etc. It's like how, let's call them idiosyncratic, lot of the swings were.
Self-taught,
kind of, they look like hackers, but they're not. These are the best golfers in the entire world. And Nicklaus on 18, driving through the green into the rough at the top, just by the fans, and poor old Doug Saunders, like, just, oh my God, heartbreak stuff. And Jack, God bless him, Jack put his arm around Doug. But what can Jack say? Yeah. What could Jack
great
say?
Image. Great image.
It's an amazing image.
Jack's had quite a few of them, hasn't he? I mean, you even think Watson at Turnberry walking off and telling him, "I gave you my best shot." And Watson saying that was like the best thing anyone ever said to me, really, you know?
Tony Jacklin at the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, pretty classy, actually.
Sure. One more thing, Joe.
Yes, go on.
Just before you go, looking for some help from the Golf Weekly listeners. I was listening to Newstalk Breakfast this morning. They were talking about great sports documentaries, and somebody brought up a documentary that was made by the Golf Channel called Payne the Golfer.
Oh, yeah.
It was made, I don't know exactly when it was made, but it was last broadcast in October of 2019. I can't find it anywhere. Everywhere I've seen it reviewed online is just talking about what an amazing hour it was of nostalgia and going through the life and the career of Payne Stewart. If there's anybody out there that can find a link or point me somewhere in the right direction, I'd be very grateful for it.
Okay, shout the Twitter handle.
At Golf Weekly NT.
It's at Golf Weekly OTB. I meant your one in case they want to tweet you.
So, well, that's how long it is since I've been on this show. I think it was originally set up as Golf Weekly. I think at Dave McIntyre, IRL.
Okay, very good. Right, fellas. Dave, you got to get back to, you know, the war zone. And
can we not do another hour, please?
Yeah. And Fiona and I, we'll get back to, I don't know, walking around the house for a while. Dave, thanks a million. I'm sure we'll be borrowing your services over the next couple of weeks.
It was a pleasure, gents.
Okay, thanks, lads. Fionn, come on. Thanks a million.
Thanks, guys.
Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.